Welcome to the ETM Macro Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Jonathan Witt, who is an anaesthetist and a prolific and well-known podcaster in South Africa, and also a very astute political commentator. Very active on Twitter is Jonathan at Jonathan_Witt. Jonathan, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Russ. I think my Twitter gives me away. I was told today I'm not nice enough on Twitter. Someone shouting at me told me I'm not a very nice person while telling me horrible things about myself. if you like to be challenged a little bit, then Twitter is where to find me, I guess.
Look, if people on Twitter say you're not a nice guy, then you maybe need to start worrying, Jono.
I know. It's such a lovely place, Twitter. It's such a nice site. And really, what you really want is you want approval from people on Twitter. I know I don't look for it in my family. I much prefer to find it on Twitter.
Jonathan, I'd like to jump straight in. You're a doctor. I brought you in. I want to talk about coronavirus. Even more importantly, I want to sort of move the conversation on to what we're seeing on the ground in South Africa, and particularly actually from a kind of policy and political response perspective. My clients care a lot about the prospect of lockdown and how long that's going to last and whether there's kind of political appetite to continue extending it. And so I'd like to, not that you have all the insights into the inside tracks of all that, but trying to unpack some of your thinking around that would be great. I want to start us off by looking at this from the biggest possible perspective. And just looking at this global pandemic as we have it, this completely almost unbelievable 2 months that we've just come through, where we've all had to kind of reevaluate our finances, our lives, the way we see what's coming. Just an incredibly chaotic time, a time where we've taken on massive amounts of new information. How bad is coronavirus for you, and how worried should we be from a global kind of public health perspective? I mean, how bad is this thing that we're looking at? Is this a very nasty virus, or has this been overhyped?
Yeah, this is actually quite a tough question, because how bad something is often very subjective, actually. And a lot of what we've done with regards to coronavirus has not been very objective. I would like to preface everything I say by just saying that the realities are that nobody really knows everything at this stage. And anyone who's telling you they know that a lockdown works or a lockdown doesn't work, or that we'll be over this in 6 months or 18 months, or all of these sort of predictions, we're all kind of shooting in the dark a little bit. There is data, and there's many people going various sort of directions with the data. But I do think it's important to note that I reckon only in about 2 years' time will we be able to start saying specific things and seeing who was right about the predictions and who was wrong. And I know there's a lot of people suggesting that they knew things in January and they sounded the alarm and so on and so forth. And I just don't think that it's the right time to claim victory yet for anyone. We're just not sure where we are. In terms of just saying how serious it is from a health perspective. Look, it's serious. It's a serious illness. I know people hate the flu comparison, but the reality is that it's like a severe flu that is both in symptoms and in what is ultimately going to end up being the mortality rate. There obviously are various different case fatality rates at this stage because of how things have progressed across the world. And because of what we have and what we know from the data, the limited testing in many countries, and we really don't have any accuracy. It looks like at this stage, the epidemiologists are saying 10 times as deadly as the flu. I think that number will drop significantly. So at the moment, they're saying 1% or just above 1%. I think that number is going to drop well below 1% in the final reckoning of everything. But then to put that in context, something like MERS is a further 10 times deadlier. Something like MERS is actually about 2 or 3 times as 20 or 30 times as deadly. So it's difficult to contextualize when there's been so much kind of panic around everything. The reality is it could be a lot worse. We could have airborne Ebola. If we had airborne Ebola, I think I would be far more in line with the sort of authoritarian steps the government has taken.
So, okay, so that's a great little high-level summary. I mean, you know, one of the things that struck me today, I read some pretty good analysis on this stuff, and what you saw with H1N1, which I think, if memory serves, was that around the 2009 when H1N1 reared its head?
Yeah, 2008, 2009 was okay. The H1N1 sort of it was actually a pandemic in itself. We just didn't really care.
Yeah, so that was during the big global financial crisis, and it almost seemed like we had, you know, bigger fish to fry at that point. But what was interesting about that is, if, you know, the guy was saying that in real time, about 10 weeks after we sort of discovered that virus and got on top of it, the estimated case or infection fatality rate was somewhere around 5%, very big number. It's, you know, very similar to what we're seeing as some of the early mm-hmm. estimates for COVID-19. That ended up, when all the data was in, as you say, you know, which you can only really judge probably 2 years later, something like 0.02, just an incredibly low number. And I suspect that this is, you know, I'm not saying this is now going to be this, therefore there's a repeat, but I suspect this is pretty common, right? With pandemics, we get these early estimates. We take a kind of precautionary principle, and then we slowly revise these things down. I mean, the more data I see on this, the lower the case fatality rate seems to be getting.
It's very likely there's a repeat. So in general, when you talk about viruses, the more transmissible a virus is, the less deadly it is. Flu, for example, is relatively highly transmissible. There are things that are more transmissible, measles, for example. But in terms of how deadly those illnesses are, they're not that deadly. Now, that deadly, once again, in context, it becomes a problem because, you know, people are saying things, well, if it's my parent or my child, or, you know, if my child gets measles, it's a problem for my child, and if they die, then that's a net loss for me and my family. But if you look at them in a population context, these are not things that can wipe out the whole village or the whole city. They will take a small chunk of the population. That doesn't imply that it's not something we should be fighting against or something we should be cautious about, but it does mean that we should be able to put things in context. You know, the swine flu that you referred to, it was believed at the time that it was far deadlier than it was, and that was because they believed that roughly about 500 million people got infected over that. It was about a 9-month period. It covered the winters on both sort of ends of the world. It was mainly in America that they had the hardest hit, but there were other parts of the world too. And when they went back and reviewed it, they actually looked at it and they revised the death numbers up, but they also revised the number of people that they believe actually had H1N1 up heavily. So the denominator. So in other words, they went from about thinking that there were somewhere in the region, if I recall correctly, and I stand to be corrected slightly on these numbers, but somewhere in the region of about 300,000 deaths, they upped that to about between 500,000 and 600,000 globally, which is about the number of influenza deaths you get per year. And then they took the number of 500 million infected, and they pitched that at about 1.2 to 1.6 billion people got infected. So about 1.5 billion, call it. So the chances are that we're dealing with something very similar, but we don't know yet. And I suppose if you want to look for the argument for, okay, why the panic, why the concern, that would be it. We don't know. And so that's the reason why there's the sort of cautious approach. But I do think there's a lot of other stuff obviously happening in the background.
It doesn't feel like a sufficiently good explanation to say that we don't know, because we also didn't know with H1N1, right? These things, they get revealed in time. So, you know, what are we, 11 years on from H1N1? Social media has exploded over this last decade like never before. We've had a situation with COVID-19 where perhaps China has played a harmful role, not just in being the source of the virus, which is not necessarily something they could control, but perhaps in the way they've communicated it, the way they maybe neglected to cut international travel early enough, whatever it might be. Maybe we just have a more fearful society that seems to be more prone to fear, or maybe there was less going on in the news cycle. With H1N1, we were in the throes of, you know, one of the biggest financial crises of our lifetimes. What for you is different about this? You're a social media guy, you're a podcaster, you're a political observer. Do you think that there's something else going on here? Are we hyping this in a way that, you know, we just haven't hyped these things before?
Yeah, I mean, look, firstly, I think it's important to say that I don't believe the conspiracy theories. So these ideas that China manufactured a bioweapon because they were upset with Donald Trump and his trade war, I think that is firstly provably false and secondly quite laughable. But that also said, the Chinese can see an opportunity when it comes. The fact that they have an authoritarian regime that can crack down on civil rights and really doesn't care about barricading people in their apartment buildings until they literally die, either from the virus or from starvation, does make them put them in a position to recover a lot quicker. So they're sitting now with a relatively open economy where the rest of the world isn't. And so I do think there's a bit of a mix happening where it wasn't that China necessarily did this on purpose, but they certainly are reaping some benefit as a result of what has happened subsequently. There's a lot of things that I think have fed into this. Social media is probably the largest one. I think you're spot on there. We had Facebook. We barely had Twitter in 2008, 2009. The numbers of people on those platforms were very different. The purpose of Facebook was very different. We didn't have a news feed. There was no such thing as a news feed on Facebook. That wasn't the purpose of it. There was an Instagram. The WhatsApp didn't exist. We had BBM. If anyone remembers those, I'm sure a lot of the people listening would have had a BlackBerry. But all of these social media platforms have grown and are very different now in what they do. And I know, you know, I'm from a medical perspective, I'm so tired of the WhatsApp groups and all the sort of forwarded messages. And I get the medical ones as well as the sort of general public ones. And I'm sure everyone's sort of got a bit of an overload. And I do think that a lot of social media has played into this. I've been astonished to almost witness people discovering their own mortality in real time. You know, I deal with death on almost a daily basis. I hope I am a good doctor, so I don't have a lot of patients unfortunately die in my care. But obviously working in hospitals and working in the state sector, it does happen. I'm very aware that you can die from many a thing at any point. And most people leave their houses in the morning not realizing that they have somewhere between a 1 in 50 to a 1 in 100 chance of dying in their car that day. And you take that risk, understandably so. So social media has definitely amplified this. And I think there's been almost a feedback mechanism and loop which has happened, where the government has said, look, there's a coronavirus. These are the public health concerns. People have then taken those concerns, amplified them, add a little bit of, you know, Wikipedia and Facebook research in there, and suddenly you have this sort of feedback from the general population going back to politicians of we're all going to die. And then the politicians then are reacting to that. And I think that's a very dangerous loop that's been created. In my opinion, if we had the exact same social media platforms and setup in 2008-09, we would have shut down the world exactly the same. And I do not see us exceeding the number of deaths by much as a result of coronavirus. That argument can be made, it's because of the lockdowns and things that we've done, sure. But if we don't even come within half of the number of deaths, the question then becomes, well, where would we have ended up? And there will be modeling that is done once we have all the data, and it will be far more accurate to tell us that. But I think social media has played a big role. Just quickly to talk to your point about China, and I think that is a huge aspect of both what's come out of this, what will be the sort of return to normal, everyone's saying how the world has changed. I'm not convinced the world's changed that much. I think humans are humans, and they will get back in their cars and go back to their office buildings and eat their chicken burgers at lunch and so on and so forth. But I do think things that have changed are the sort of approach to China. I do think it's very obvious to most people that the dishonesty of that regime places the entire world at risk. Public health, I'm not a huge fan of public health, because These are doctors who obviously I have respect for, but they approach the world in a collectivist way, and I am not a collectivist. And so, you know, these are the type of people who push for a sugar tax, because you couldn't possibly be trusted as an individual to control your sugar intake. So it must be controlled for you. And the sort of public health people will look at something like this, and, you know, instant government control isn't necessarily something they would see as a negative. But the way they work is with normal disease patterns and disease control is they will identify who has the disease. They will lock those people down and their contacts. They'll do contact tracing and lock those people down. And I think what had happened with coronavirus is there was an overload of that system. Certainly in a place like South Africa, where we don't have as many resources as we probably should, but even in places like the United States and Europe, the system was overloaded. Now, if China had been honest in December and January, we may be in a very different position today in terms of the world.
Let's bring it to SA. So we sit in this world of hype and social media and the fear cycle and the media cycle. And of course, the meme that very quickly got going in SA was this, you know, this these what four words, ripping through the townships. This was the sort of hook that got people very, very worried about South Africa, an immunocompromised population, and this rips through the township as the South African winter, you know, takes hold. And I don't want to poo-poo that necessarily. I mean, again, as you say, there's so much we don't know. But that's clearly driven a lot of fear. And I don't think that's necessarily the only reason why we find ourselves in draconian lockdown. But from what I hear from the public health people that seem to be advising the government, there just seems to have been stoked a tremendous amount of fear. Are you still picking that up in the sort of public sector health space, that there's still this tremendous concern of what may still come for South Africa?
Yeah, look, certainly amongst doctors, I think there is a fear. I'm finding amongst junior colleagues an irrational fear where they are abandoning their scientific reasoning skills. And that is almost a daily challenge at the moment, to try and speak to colleagues and explain to them, you know, how to understand the risk and how to approach the risk in a way that is not panic induced. That has been a major problem. I must say, certainly amongst the senior staff dealing with this, they are very much taking it in their stride. I think they are handling it very well. And there's been some incredible sort of planning and action that's taken place, even though we haven't required much healthcare resource yet. So I do feel a sense of anxiety and fear amongst the just doctors in general. I would say that applies both public and private sector. In terms of the community and the public, there's a few interesting points of view I have on this. So one is that yes, people are afraid because they've been told to be afraid. I walked into a shop yesterday, and on the sound system was playing a church sermon of sorts. And the pastor was saying how we all need to repent because this is happening because we need to repent. And so I do think that there's almost a sense of fear that's been put out there. I'm not sure where that started. And then sort of this kind of misinformation that happens as a result of that. But I also think South Africans are incredibly hardy. And, you know, most South Africans live in quite torrid sort of circumstances. These are people, at least 45 million of whom don't have access to decent healthcare for the most part, certainly not advanced decent healthcare for the most part. They have bad things happen to them all the time from a healthcare perspective and an economic perspective. This is a country which still hasn't really gotten over the problem of children dying from vomiting and diarrheal illnesses, and specifically the diarrheal illnesses. You know, babies regularly die. You would be hard pressed to walk down a township street in South Africa and find, you know, not find a house where at least a family had been affected by that and had lost a child. You know, many people certainly in this decade, we have largely got on top of it, but in the previous decade, were losing people to HIV. I started practicing medicine at that point, and previously was involved in the emergency services, and you know, the AIDS death toll was unbelievable, and it was really something horrific to behold. So I tend to feel that there will come a time, I think some people are already thinking this, where a lot of South Africans, average South Africans, will look at this and go, you know, I've had a lot of bad things happen to me, and I'm not seeing this as the threat I've been told it is, and I'm going to take my chances because, you know, it can't be worse than the daily grind. And just one thing to say, which is that if, you know, one of the major, if not the major driver of morbidity and mortality in this country is poverty. It's not COVID-19 and it won't be COVID-19. It's not influenza. It's not any of those things. It's poverty and all of the negative effects that poverty leads to. Is our population specifically at risk? You speak about the phrase of ripping through the townships. We don't have evidence for that. I don't know why we are assuming that will happen. There currently is no evidence that HIV is a predisposing risk factor to developing COVID once you've become infected with a SARS-CoV-2 virus. There's furthermore no evidence to show that if you are HIV positive and are on ARVs, remember we have the world's largest ARV program, that you will be at any greater risk than any other person would be from the virus and subsequent disease. So I just find that difficult to believe. I could be wrong. And obviously a lot of people are saying, look, we'd rather be overcautious and find out that we were wrong in the end. But my worry is on the economic side of things and the damage that that will have and wreak on people and the subsequent health effects that that will cause, which may be very difficult to quantify.
I think one of my friends talks about this being a problem of saliency, that we sort of overly focus on the problem we can see or that we think we can see, and we obviously completely discount and underestimate the problem that we're building up, the unseen problem that we're building up in the background, which, as you say, you know, very much relates to this issue of poverty. If we go through a 10%, 15% GDP drop in SA, you know, just what that can do from a poverty perspective. And I think a lot of people haven't thought much about what this means for Africa as a whole. You know, you've got, you know, a few hundred million people that are right on the cusp of either getting sucked back into deep impoverishment or kind of, you know, pulling out. And actually, yeah, you know, a depression created by global supply shutdowns actually really matters to these guys. Jono, one of the reasons why I love chatting to doctors at this moment in time is because you guys are out and about. I'm on lockdown. You guys are out and about, but more than that, you are in your hospitals getting briefings, I suspect having, you know, team meetings. And as a result, you know, my perception is that a lot of doctors are hearing some interesting information about what's going on out there. One of the pieces of information I got from a doctor friend the other day is that things aren't actually going so well in the townships on this lockdown. There's a lot of violence apparently in Cape Town. The gangs are having quite a field day under lockdown, from what I can sort of pick up. What are some of the things you're hearing about real life out there in SA as we sit through this lockdown period?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think some people are taking advantage. I've also heard of a bit of gang violence and syndicates which are having, a real good time of this. The notion that we have a large enough police force and military to lock down our country is just not true. And it's a particular worry for me in terms of if things turn particularly violent. You know, we're forcing people to go without salaries, people who normally live hand to mouth on a daily basis, everyone from waiters to domestic workers to gardeners to builders. These are people who feed themselves almost on a daily basis with what they made that day. We're forcing those people to go for more than a month without a salary. I'm very worried about the civil unrest that might result in, and the fact that our entire military is smaller than the population of Alexandra Township. So if that township riots, good luck. In terms of what's been happening, I have to say we're a lot more quiet than we thought we would be. It does seem to be relatively quiet on the healthcare front. Now, that's not a good thing. That's somewhat concerning. Everyone I've spoken to around the country seems to have very small patient numbers coming into their casualties, very small patient numbers coming to their theatres and to their wards. And the reason I'm concerned, now some people aren't because they're saying, oh, well, there's no alcohol, so it's great. We're not getting trauma and people aren't stabbing each other as much and shooting each other and all that. And I suppose to some extent that is true. But at the same time, we're seeing far less of the normal cases we would see, the diabetics that have, some sores on their feet that need to be attended to, which if left for 2 or 3 months are just going to end up meaning more amputations. The guy who's been having a sort of sore stomach for the last month and decided not to come to hospital because he thinks he's going to get infected with this virus. So he sits with a sore stomach, and instead of it just being his hernia, it ends up being an incarcerated hernia, and he ends up having quite a complicated medical and surgical course as a result of that. At least might been my exposure so far, quite quiet on the sort of Eastern Front. And we're all sort of waiting for the tsunami from COVID. But I am worried after COVID, what happens to all these patients, all these surgeries that have been pushed back and postponed.
But maybe you could just help us understand what's going on there. Why has there been a huge drop off in admissions for all these other things?
So the outpatient clinics are, private and public is the same. So public would be something like an outpatient clinic. Let's say you have a sinus problem and you go to the ear, nose and throat outpatient clinic and they say, no, look, we're going to do a surgery on you. And they would normally say, cool, we're going to do a surgery on you. And, in the public sector, you would wait a couple of months, but you'd ultimately be booked for a certain date and you'd come on that date and you'd get your surgery. But we've put a stop to all elective procedures and that would count as elective. So you don't have to have it. You just will be uncomfortable at home with your sinus problem. But that applies to all medical problems across the board that are not emergent. So, and we would classify emergent as something that is likely to either cause you severe morbidity or cause you death in the near future. So if you come to theater with a brain bleed, if you come to hospital with a brain bleed, then we will absolutely sort you out, operate on you and all of the rest. But if if you come into the neurosurgery outpatient clinic with a headache, which could in a 60-year-old be a tumor, we aren't attending to that just yet. We aren't doing those scans. We aren't doing all that stuff. So we're going to have a backlog in the system. This is what I talk about when I say, we may have unforeseen, unquantifiable health effects as a result of locking down. The private sector, all my colleagues in the private sector are quiet as hell. So their practices aren't running, but they still owe rent. They still have to pay their secretaries. No elective cases are happening. So there are going to be lots of doctors as well who will be in quite a bit of financial issues at the end of this, I would reckon. But they may be able to catch up. It's just of concern that we are not seeing a lot of these patients. And the longer you leave any health issue, if you're the kind of guy who's 45 years old and you've been sitting at home with this sort of nagging chest pain every time you climb the stairs, and you would have gone to to see your physician or the cardiologist or whoever last week, but you couldn't because there's a lockdown and your problem isn't that bad and you don't see it as a huge problem. And if you present it to an emergency department, they probably wouldn't pick up anything major. No one's going to put you on a treadmill to stress ECG you right now. So you're going to sit with that. So your coronary arteries maybe are getting even more blocked while you wait for the lockdown to end. So that when we end this lockdown, you maybe are in a worse position than you were before. You maybe are in a catastrophic position compared to where you would have been 6 weeks earlier. There are so many potential effects from a health perspective that are, we can't quantify, but we know are going to be there and are going to cause a problem in the system in the future.
So one of the reasons for the lockdown is to not overwhelm the healthcare system. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that after the lockdown, the healthcare system could get overwhelmed.
Yeah, and I think the public healthcare system is almost in a state of being permanently overwhelmed. I think that would be a very difficult thing to argue against. There are waiting lists. If you need a new hip or knee, there are waiting lists that can be up to 3 years long. That's just the reality of it. Look, you're going to come to theater eventually, and you're going to get your new hip or knee, and it's not going to cost you nearly what it ends up costing someone in the private sector or what it ends up costing their medical aid. But the bottom line is there's a wait, and the reason there's a wait is because the system is at capacity. And yeah, I do think that we may see a very additionally stressed system at the end of this. The other point to make about that whole idea of flattening the curve is we haven't been very we haven't been very nuanced in how we've approached that. So we took one graph, which, by the way, has very little data behind it. So it's based on the swine flu. It's one article published in the mid-2000s, which looked historically at the 1918 pandemic and compared, if I'm not mistaken, St. Louis and New Orleans, and compared the two outbreaks in those two cities, and then said, well, the one city kind of put in measures to try and prevent spread, and the other didn't, and they should have. The one had a spike and the other one didn't, and the one had a catastrophic amount of deaths and the other didn't. And that's where the curve came from. The problem I have with the flattening the curve is, where are the numbers? There are no numbers on that curve. And so the issue is, and where is the breakpoint? Because everyone knows the healthcare resource line. The question is, okay, in South Africa, where is our healthcare resource line? Now, you might argue that our healthcare resource line is actually on the x-axis. We don't have any capacity in the health system, which you then may say, well, that's the reason we need a lockdown immediately. But at the same time, if we do have a healthcare line that sits above the curve at any point, at which point in the curve are we meant to shut down? At a 20% hospital capacity, at a 50% capacity? We don't know this. And not enough of these types of analytical questions are being asked about the decisions we're making. Now, I can't say they're not being asked in the closed level meetings at the highest level. I'm not involved there. But based on many of the decisions that are being made, it's hard to see that they're being considered very seriously.
So, John, let's move on to this idea of this lockdown. And the idea that I've been putting forward to my clients is one of a competing set of narratives here. The one narrative is the fear of the virus, the fear of what it can do in terms of the loss of human life. And the other narrative is the counter narrative to that is the fear of what we're doing to the economy. Now, we've just extended lockdown for 2 weeks. To my mind, this just compounds an already very, very bad macroeconomic situation even more. So this narrative to me becomes decisive. So I've got a couple of questions on this for you. My sense is that this week, it's been interesting. I've seen a few big headlines and a few, you know, pretty important politicians talking about, hang on, the cure might be worse than the disease here. You know, we can't extend these lockdowns indefinitely. So the fear of what we're doing economically seems to be rising, and I sense that the fear of the virus is slowly receding. You know, I don't know that a tipping point has been reached yet, and it seems to me that the decisive place that this narrative battle, you know, is happening and needs to hold sway is in the sort of medical community, because it seems governments are taking direct, you know, putting heavy weight on the advice of the medical, you know, community and the medical fraternity. So my question to you is, A, do you think that narrative shift is happening finally as people start to wake up to what's going on from a macro perspective economically and how damaging this is going to be? And B, do you think that the medical community, that doctors, that public health officials are grokking the problem of you know, what we're doing from an economic perspective and how that's going to have its own huge set of public health, you know, dynamics?
Yeah, I don't get the sense it's shifting. I get the sense there's a shift. There's a definite shift in some other countries. There's certainly a shift in Central Europe. You've seen different approaches being taken there from the get-go. Sweden is obviously the notable example. I know people will point to the rising number of deaths in Sweden, but you really cannot judge this until we've finished, until the sort of third act has happened, and it hasn't happened yet. We need to look at it in a year's time and go, okay, look, Sweden ended up much worse than, you know, France, for example. If that happens, then we can say, okay, Sweden made the wrong choices. But Sweden would be one example. Holland is another example, who's done a partial lockdown, but has kept things like schools open, does believe in sort of a modified herd immunity approach. The US, look, the Americans are not, the average American is not dealing with this very well. You know, I have a sort of personal interest and sort of hobby in American politics, and the average American is not tolerating their freedoms being violated. I cannot see this being extended past the end of April. I think they'll listen to Trump until the end of April, and then there will be a mass revolt. There's already been areas of America where people are doing as they please, and I think even in a country like that, you might see sort of civil unrest. In South Africa, I do not see us moving away from this belief that the lockdown is working and that the lockdown needs to be in place as long as possible. I'm not seeing that happen enough. There are clearly a lot of people who can see the issues and the economic problem. And I suppose that talks to your second question, which is with regards to, you know, the doctors and the influence and the economy. We have structured, and it's not only us, but everyone has really structured their response to this around a medical response, around what the doctors, the public health officials have to say. And I think that that is an error. I think what the doctors and the public health officials have to say is incredibly important, but I think it should be a multidisciplinary team. We are not just fiddling with hospitals. We are not just fiddling with patient care. We are fiddling with entire economies and entire countries. And that is not something that most doctors know anything about. And so it should be the kind of discussion where we have the same high level people we have from the medical field. We should have those level of people from the banking world, from the economic sector, giving their advice and their input and their models. Because everyone's seen these sort of graphs of the deaths from COVID. Where's the economic graph showing the economic deaths that will result? And where does that line overtake the COVID death line? And surely there should be some sort of decision point. Now, I haven't seen any of that, and I haven't seen any sort of thinking in that direction. I've seen people murmuring about it. But the suggestion is that if I haven't seen any actual designs, any sort of analytical graphs towards this sort of concept, my assumption is that that's not happening at the highest levels. And unfortunately, that means we're going to end up following what the doctors say. And if the doctors feel that a lockdown is required, they're going to carry on locking down. You know, my big concern here is we also have a split in our society where the people who can work from home, the people who are still getting salaries, don't see a problem. But the majority of our population are not people like that. And I really, really think we need to try and be pragmatic about this sooner rather than later, because the results could be really quite detrimental and, in my opinion, quite violent.
So we've extended lockdown in South Africa to the end of April. That's an extra 2 weeks. That'll be 5 weeks in total. And it seems to me like the president is really, by doing that, is stretching the nation's patience. I would expect that that will be the end of what's called formal lockdown, but that doesn't mean we just come out and life goes back to normal. Do you have a sense of what that roadmap might look like? How we come out of lockdown? Is there some sort of semi-lockdown situation? I mean, and how many months do you think we're talking as? Does this linger well through the winter for you?
Yeah, look, I've tried behind the scenes to give advice as far as possible on where we should be going. I was really pushing for us to end the lockdown after the first sort of lockdown, before the extension. There was a lot of work done by many people, advocates, politicians, etc., behind the scenes, doctors, to try and bring an end to the lockdown under some sort of reasonable measures. It's not to say that we can go back to normal, and it's not to say that we forget about the virus, don't care about people. It's to say that we take what we know about the virus and what we know about transmission, and we do our best to try and mitigate that transmission, which would still result in the so-called flattening of the curve. It would just allow for freedom and for the economy to actually take over, at least at some level, obviously not at 100%. The government obviously decided on their 2 week extension, but either way, if we do come out of this at the end of those 2 week extension, I expect we'll see things like the social distancing to stay in place, the hand washing, hand sanitizing, all of that to stay in place and to become sort of common part of life. There will be, just on a side note, a long-term problem with all the hand washing that's happened, which is we're going to get a spike in bacterial infections somewhere down the line, probably many years down the line, but it will happen. And the addition of probably face masks, which up until 2 weeks ago, everyone from government to the WHO to the CDC was saying don't work. I was a big proponent, having actually changed my opinion. So if you'd asked me 6 weeks ago if the public should wear masks, I would have said no. And then I went and did a lot of research into it, and my opinion actually changed. And about 4 weeks after my opinion changed, thank goodness governments did. They're a little bit late, but nevertheless, unfortunately, the WHO is still holding on their no masks policy, but I'm hoping they'll change soon. So I think those will be some of the changes that will happen. I know there have been some proposals about you know, allowing businesses to go back, but at 50% of the number of people in the office, with, you know, certain amount of square meterage between each person in the office, no communal gathering areas, that type of stuff. I expect the social gathering stuff will stay in place probably through the year. Do we peak in winter? Yes, we do, but because we chose to lock down. So the modeling that I'm looking at, which I trust currently, because it's based on other epidemics and not just on this one, so it isn't guessing and day by day adjusting its modeling down. The classic examples would be the Imperial College model, which was wrong by several 100%. The IMHE model in the United States, which was also wrong by several 100%, and it keeps getting sort of brought down over and over. This modeling says basically that the pandemic will take somewhere in the order of 70 days to get through, from outbreak to rise to plateau to descent. If you lock down, you will just prolong that process. So we've locked down. So take our 35 days of lockdown, add it to the 70. So we will have roughly a 105-day pandemic or epidemic in this country. And I think that's what's likely to happen. I also think that there's a sense of, and there's a fact of inevitability, which some people would like to avoid. There's this belief that we can stop this from happening. We can stop the coronavirus altogether. That is completely naive. This is a novel virus. It will find its way into our population. It will infect a large percentage of our population, and eventually it will go away. It's very likely, in my opinion, that we live with coronavirus, and I have been saying this since the beginning, as one of the viruses that you just get. So we will often have patients in ICU. They get a pneumonia, and we test them for all the bacterial stuff, and we get nothing back. And then we go, oh, it must be a viral pneumonia, and we do a respiratory panel on them and look for a viral pneumonia. And even if we don't find it, we know it's a viral pneumonia. It presents in a certain way. It behaves in a certain way. And so in 5 years' time, coronavirus or COVID won't be a big deal, but we may still be, in fact, we will still be having patients, in my view, coming into the hospital and ending up in ICU, and we'll be like, oh, yeah, that's the COVID patient over there. But it will not be on the scale, obviously, because the virus won't be new to our immune systems.
Jonathan, last question. This has been a really informative time. As you look forward, what are some of the things that concern you the most? A, from a public health perspective, maybe B, from a sort of political and civil liberties perspective, as you survey the sort of landscape. I mean, that's probably a whole separate podcast in itself, but just some final closing thoughts on the things that you're watching closely as you survey this landscape, and the things that are maybe of concern to you the most.
Yeah, look, as a doctor who is one of the people who will end up ventilating patients, I am still concerned about, obviously, a massive influx to the hospitals. My colleagues who I have in parts of the US, including New York, my colleagues working in the UK in the NHS, have described quite chaotic scenes to me. And I don't see a reason why we won't go through that at some level in this country. I'm not convinced that it's actually avoidable. So, you know, just on a personal level, I am concerned about that, and obviously about a period of relatively large loss of life that we will go through, which will be obviously painful for individuals and families to deal with. But on a broader perspective, I am very worried about two things. One is the economy. I worry that we were an economy in major trouble before this, that this may be irrecoverable. You know, you look at an economy like the United States, they're now forecasting up to 40 million people out of work. I know that if the United States is struggling, it means generally that every other country will be struggling. We were not in a good position before this. I am very, very worried about where we will be after this, especially for the majority of South Africans who really are in a tough position on a day-to-day basis. And then the other side of that coin is really the loss of freedoms and liberty that has happened. As you know, I am quite a serious classical liberal, and I take freedom and liberty very seriously. I have been flabbergasted not only to see government implementing quite draconian measures and being very authoritarian, but to see people embracing those authoritarian measures and acting like a Stasi and reporting their their fellow South Africans, their neighbours, to authorities for things that are clearly are very benign, but because the government says they are bad, they must obviously be reported on. I am not convinced we get back all our rights when this is over. We may get them back in theory, in the sense that the disaster provision disappears. But do the police go back to behaving in a normal fashion? Do the military go back? Do they get pulled out? Are the laws around free speech all taken away, or are we not allowed to challenge government on certain things? Do they turn around and go, well, it turned out that not having alcohol was a good idea, we feel, so therefore we're going to continue certain bans on alcohol / cigarettes. I'm very worried about those freedoms. And then finally, Russ, I know we talk about this quite a bit, but the ANC has a thing called the National Democratic Revolution. It is the policy that underpins everything they do. It's basically Soviet-style governance, and it essentially speaks to the idea of seizing the means of production. It's following a socialism to communism route. I know people think this is a massive conspiracy theory, but it really, really isn't. The mining sector would be one area to just point to where that has essentially happened. And I am a bit concerned that in all the chaos, the ANC sees economic collapse as potentially an opportunity, that they look at this economic collapse and they go, well, it's not ideal. Certainly the money flows are not ideal. But if the private sector collapses, it's not a problem because the public sector will just take it over. There's already been utterings from the Minister of Health about how he might nationalize the private healthcare system through this. If that happens, does he unnationalize it afterwards? Does he half unnationalize it? If the lockdown goes on for much longer, do the private hospitals even survive as entities? If enough people lose their jobs, do the medical aides survive as entities? These are major, major concerns and could rapidly increase the authoritarian nature of our government and the loss of freedoms for people living here.
Jonathan, you've been an incredibly informative guest with a wonderful breadth of insight. Greatly appreciate having you on. All the best as you go out and get onto the front lines, as it were, and much health and happiness to your family through this time. Cheers.
Thanks, Russ. Appreciate it.